Zeit hinter Chayesora, und ja, apparently meant hinter die Sidra Chayesora.
Wow.
Ipsa facto are inside in the covenantal community. We are all members of this enigmatic, mysterious, and strange community, which was formed by our ancestor, Abraham, whose life story has been told in three sidrot, in Genesis, beginning with Lech Lecha, and concluding with Chayesor. We all know the Midrashic viewpoint that the lives of the patriarchs portray the total historical experience of our people. Accordingly, the Chayei Avot are to be seen and interpreted within two frames of reference. First, as an individual life story, as a biography of a certain man called Abraham, or a certain woman called Sarah. Second, as patterns and paradigms of future unfolding of Jewish history, or as a corpus symbolicum of historical dynamics of our people. There are two kinds of covenant, or I would rather say two covenants. The patriarchic covenant, which God concluded with the patriarchs, Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, and the Sinaitic covenant, which God concluded with Moses, and Moses with the people. The nature of the Sinaitic covenant, the covenant of Matan Torah, and also the repetition of that covenant when they were about to enter Eretz Yisrael, and again the repetition of the covenant between the two mountains, Har Gerizim and Har Ebal, after they had entered the promised land. The nature of all those covenants, I mean the Sinaitic, the covenant in the land of Moab, and the covenant in Eretz Yisrael, the nature of those covenants is plain. We have committed ourselves to Tayyad Mitzvot, the 613 Mitzvot, to which no one else is committed. I must add, I mean, boys who study Kedushin know that, that the covenant is an agreement, and in halachic terms, a shtar is chayvus. In the same manner as one can write a shtar, chayv ani lachmone, and deliver the shtar to his neighbor, and actually precipitate indebtedness by the delivery of the shtar, so did our ancestors sign the shtar, deliver to Moses, to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. They've accepted obligations, and actually the delivery of this shtar generated some indebtedness on the part of the Jew to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But however, the nature of the covenant is clear. The question arises, what is the nature of the patriarchic commitment or covenant? The patriarchic covenant, which God concluded with Abraham, with Yitzchak again, and a third time with Jacob, the nature of that covenant remains an enigma. After all, no commandments were included in that covenant, with the exception of one mitzvah. Namely, you all know, I don't have to knew it. What did the covenant accomplish? What does the covenant demand from man, from the Jew? And what is the relevance of the covenant to us now? It's quite interesting that the Torah, in formulating the Sinaitic covenant, mentions the patriarchic agreement. I should have said, mentions first the patriarchic agreement. In the Sinaitic covenant recorded in Bechukesai, the Torah states, V'zacharti es brisi Yaakov, V'gam es brisi Yitzchok, V'gam es brisi Avraham ezeker, V'oret ezeker. And then the Torah concludes, V'zacharti lehem bris rishonim, Asher etzei seisom eret Mitzrayim leinei hagoyim, V'yeis lehem lodikim. And as a matter of fact, in the Broch of Zichronot, that we recite on Rosh Hashanah, we have introduced both Zichrones, the Zichron of the Patriarchic Covenant as well as the Zichron of the Sinaitic Covenant. Apparently, these two covenants are complementary. The Patriarchic Covenant is the backdrop of the Sinaitic. If not for the Brit Avot, the Sinaitic Covenant could have never been achieved. Let me restate. The Sinaitic Covenant is only related to the human deed, to human performance. It charts a way of doing things in all areas of human endeavor. In contradistinction to that covenant, the patriarchic covenant addresses itself not to the human deed, but to the human personality as a whole, to the essence of our consciousness. I would rather say of our I-consciousness, to the fundamental trait of human character. The patriarchic covenant is an existential covenant. It blazed the trail within the jungle of the human I-awareness and tried to tell man who he is, or rather I would say who he should be. He told man how to experience his own reality, how to feel as a human being, and how to be conscious of himself as a man, as a human being, and as a Jew, as a member of the covenantal community. In other words, the Sinaitic covenant tells the Jew what to do and how to act as a member of the covenantal community. The patriarchal covenant teaches the Jew how to feel as a member of that community and how to experience being a Jew. It's a great experience, but not everyone knows how to experience the situation. Of course, I cannot, within the frame of this year, by the way, what time is sunset? 4:41. 4:41. So what's about Mir?
We doubt.
You doubt, but I didn't doubt. I'm also a member of the covenantal community.
You wish to doubt now?
I'll apologize. I'll make it just that. For the break, for the pause, about 10 minutes, doesn't take more than 10 minutes. And I'll stay with this, all right?
If there are some. There are some who haven't davened. Perhaps we can have a minion. We can make a minion.
All right, make a Jewish. All
right.
Would you remove?
Are there any others that didn't daven? We can come over to this.
The mirror will also be on tape.
Willie.
What?
What? take something later on.
Okay. Of course, I'm going to repeat it. Of course, I cannot, within the frame of this share, explore the covenant personality in total. I wish to single out one trait of this mysterious personality. And I believe that this trait is mentioned, this characteristic trait, is mentioned right in the first verse of our parasha, the way Rashi has interpreted. However, before I take up this theme, permit me to point out, in form of an introductory remark, the following idea. It's quite, it will be important to the discussion of our subject matter. The covenant was reached not with one, but with two people. Let me say, the number is not the relevant factor. What is significant and relevant is the fact that the covenant encompasses men and women. Both at creation and at the first rendezvous between God and man, the God addressed himself to two people, to man and the woman. God created not one human being, but two, male and female, Zohar and Kiva Boreisom, both together, he called Adam, Vayikro and Shmom Adam. A single person, man or woman, is not called Adam, but together, God called them, their name Adam. Adam alone would have never been awarded the greatest of all gifts, his humanity, or what we call it, Imago Dei, the Tzelem Elokim. Only men and the women who were crowned with the Imago Dei, with the divine nature. In other words, human reality is a dual one. The dual human reality at creation transcends the physiological sex differentiation. It reaches into the metaphysical. The very verse, God created man in his own image. Male and female created he them. And he called them Adam, contradicts the perverse notion as if Judaism has preached the inferiority of the woman to man. It also cuts away another false notion, namely that there is no distinction between a woman and a man. When I'm speaking about distinction, I mean in metaphysical terms. As some so-called female chauvinists try to tell us, if there's a male chauvinist, there's a female chauvinist as well. It is wrong to say that God made both men and women because they differ physiologically. He made both men and women because they differ existentially, metaphysically. However, they don't differ axiologically, I mean in terms of values. Both bear the image of God, hence there cannot be any axiological differentiation between them. We should rather say that he created a dual, a dual, I emphasize that, I underline it, human existence, men and women, because they complement each other. They have two existential human destinies. Together, they represent one destiny, but a perfect one. The same is true of the covenant. God closed the covenant with both, Abraham and Sarah. The latter was an equal partner of Abraham. At times, while we study Chumash and try to get some insight into the Chumash, we are tempted to think that she, Sarah, was the central figure. You know to what Rashi I'm referring. We read this verse last Shabbos, Kila Shatemer Lachosor, Shema Betrever. We read last Shabbos morning that the Almighty instructed Abraham to comply with Sarah's wish and send Hagar and Ishmael away. 2 weeks ago, in Parshas Lech Lecha, a week ago in Parshas Lech Lecha, we read about the conversation between God and Abraham. Abraham interceded on behalf of Ishmael. Vayimer Avraham el Elokim, lu Ishmael yichye lefanecho. Vayimer Elokim, avol sora ishtecho yelev lefanecho bein, vikoros וקורוס שמי יצחוק, וכמייסי בריסי איתי, איסי איתי, לבריסי לא. And Abraham said unto God, oh, that Ishmael might live before this. And God said, the translation is indeed, I would say, the but would fit better, much better than the indeed. Avol, but Sarah, thy wife, shall bear thee a son, and I will establish my covenant with him. For a covenant forever. In short, Abraham, my covenant cannot be realized without Isaac. Why? Because Isaac is the son of Sarah. Avos Sarah ish tachor yeladez lachodayim. He represents both, you and her. Yishmoel represents only you. Yitzchak will represent both, you and her. And there is no covenant without her. We also read that Shabbos, that the very instant Abraham's name was changed, to Abraham, the hay, the symbol of power and mastery over the multitude, was added, Sarai's name underwent a similar change. The hay replaced the yud, you all know. Vayemer alekim el Avraham, Sarai ishtecho letitra shmo Sarai, ki Sora shmo. As for Sarai, thy wife, thou shalt not call her name Sarai, but Sarah shall her name be. It is quite remarkable that the Almighty did not say that he changes her name from Sarah into Sarah. The same way as he told Abraham, V'hoyo shimcho Avraham, but thy name shall be Abraham. Concerning Sarai, God just informed Abraham that her name was changed already to Sarah. Vayemer adikim el Avraham, Sarai ishtecho letitra shmo Sarai. You know why? Because something happened. You are not informed by me. But I have changed the name already. When he addressed himself to Abraham about his own name, he said, I am changing the name. Abraham into Abraham. But when he addressed himself to Abraham concerning Sarah's name, he didn't tell Abraham, I changed the name. And from now on, you must not call her Sarai, but Sarah. But he said differently. Don't call her Sarai because her name is Sarah. It was not in order, but But he informed him. Why is it so? And when was Sarah's name changed? When Abraham's name was changed, of course. For there is an existential interdependence between Abraham and Sarah. And Abraham cannot be Av Amongin, the king of many peoples, if Sarah is not crowned as the queen of those peoples. In a word, not only do men and women achieve together, and only together, human dignity, or achieve, I would use it, the past tense, not only did men and women achieve together and only together human dignity at creation, Imago Dei, but they also achieved together and only together covenantal sanctity when Abraham and Sarah were elected by the Almighty. Interesting is how the Torah tries to tell us about this interdependence between Abraham and Sarah. And the Torah tells us in terse terms, when Abraham came and found Sarah dead, he knew two things. First, that he lost his beloved Sarah, his beloved wife. It is a traumatic experience. But he knew something else, which no one else knew, that his mission as father of the covenantal community is completed. That from now on, all he has to do is to act out the last part of the paradoxical drama and walk off the covenantal stage and make room for somebody else to succeed in. It's very strange, I said it once. Abraham survived Sarah by, I believe, 57 years. Did he? She was 127 old, he was 175, and he was 10 years older than she. 10 years older. Yes. Huh? 30 years. Yes. Yes. Huh? 30 years, yes. But the Torah fails to report about Abraham's activities following Sarah's death. Only two events were recorded. The transaction pertaining to the Maor HaMachpelah, the purchase of the grave for Sarah, and the marrying of Isaac. The second story was told not so much to portray Abraham, but in order to acquaint us with the second mother of the covenantal community, Rebecca, who succeeded Sarah. And the last passage is very characteristic. Vaivela Yitzchok Eyalo Sorin. The vacant place, the vacuum which Sora left when she died was filled. Now the covenant can go on, can be resumed and continued, because there is a mother in the covenantal community, not only father but a mother as well. Nothing else did the Torah relate to us about Abraham. Why? Because the covenant was entrusted to two, men and a woman. If the latter is missing, the story of the covenantal community comes to a temporary halt. No wonder that the Bible says, Vayovei Avrom Lispei Lissoro Velifteso. As a matter of fact, Chi and Hesped represent two different stages or phases in Avelis. Chi, Chazal say, Shleisha Lipchi. Chi, according to the Halacha, is the primeval instinctive reaction of an individual to disaster. When it strikes suddenly, one does not mourn through crying. Crying is not mourning. For it is not an intentional act. It comes spontaneously. Whenever an individual is unexpectedly struck by catastrophe and he feels as if his whole world crumbles and collapses, he cries. It's a release of tension. But it's an instinctive, even some animals do cry. It's an instinctive reaction to surprise. Usually destructive surprise. On the contrary, respect is already a rational, intentional performance, an act of appraisal and evaluation, and an attempt to find out what happened. Respect is formulated not in emotional, in instinctual terms, but in rational, logical terms. Abraham suffered with the death of Sarah a double lesson. First, a personal one. He lost his wife. It was not just a wife, but a partner, a comrade in arms. They went through thick and thin, as he says. No one understands and appreciates the bleak loneliness and destructive nostalgia of a surviving mate. The whole world appears to be dislocated. And certainly Abraham was a human being, a great human being. He felt dislocated. His beloved Sarah was gone. However, there was another tragic, distressful experience I mentioned. Abraham did not know what was going to happen to the covenant now. He knew the secret, that the covenant was not entrusted to him alone, that the covenant was entrusted to both, to Sarah and to Abraham. And he simply didn't know what will happen now. The woman was missing. The mother of the covenantal community died. Will God have enough trust and confidence in him to entrust him the covenant, or his task is coming to a close, to a conclusion? Perhaps he had sinned, and God wants to liquidate the community. First, what Abraham did first is not to cry over his personal loss, but lispingly so, to appraise Sarah's contribution to the formation of the and successful growth of the covenantal community, what she meant and what she accomplished, and what could be done now without her. He mourned the passing of Sarah together with other members of the community, of the covenantal community. My modern death rise, there were tens of thousands of adherents of the covenant. He mourned the passing of the great woman, but in logical terms, in objective categories. And only then, after the hesped was concluded, and was more or less oriented about the future of the covenantal community, Abraham broke down and began to cry. He lost his lovely, beautiful Sarah. It's a personal loss. No one could cry with him, because only one individual cried. Now let me resume the analysis of our topic. What role has the Torah assigned to Sarah within the covenantal community? What did Sarah contribute to the community? And who was Sarah? Who was she? What kind of a person? I believe that the story, the whole story, is told in the first verse of Chayesod. But let me read to you a passage in Rashi. Everybody knows this Rashi. First Rashi. Usually people know the first Rashi. Vayiyu Chayesorom Neyoshono Ve'esrim Shono Ve'sheva Shonim Shnei Chayesorom. Strange passage. Particularly what is disturbing is the last three words. Shnei Chayesorom. It says Vayiyu Chayesorom Neyoshono Ve'esrim Shono ושבע שנים, ותומס סורו בקריה סער ויחברי. If the Torah had spoken this way, it would be a beautiful sentence. But the Torah formulated a different kind of sentence. At the end, the Torah repeats, שני חיי סור. רשי says, וכך נכתב שונו בכל כלול וכלול, למה לא? שקולך עוד נדרש לעצמי, בסקוף כבסחוף לחץ. מה בסחוף לחוטו? הבסקוף בלחץ. שראינו בס עונש. ובסחוף כבזיין לייפי. שני חיי סורו, כולם שובים לטייבו. ורשי זה אניגמטיק. We don't understand the midrash. רשי קפי זה מידרש. We don't understand what the midrash wanted to convey to us. Then how does the midrash interpret the pasuk? This is an enigma. But before I offer my interpretation of this passage, the Drashic passage, I would suggest an emendation in the text. You know, I don't play around with Gersoris and other. But I believe that this text, if rearranged, would sound much better. Baskuf. Not kibas chomesh. Baskuf the al-adi. Present text is baskuf kibas chof lechet. Ma baskuf lechoto, shareino bas onshin, al baskuf lechoto. At the age of 100, she was a woman of 20, as regards sin. For just as at the age of 20, one may regard her as having never sinned, since she has not reached the age when she would be subject to punishment, so too, when she was 100 years old, she was sinless. I mean, a question rises here immediately. What is the question? Of course, I mean, does the show matter? Human cause? In compliance with Aloha, who will punish any offender who is either 12 years old, if the offense was committed by a female, or 13 years old, if the sinner happens to be a male. Right, so let us say that Rashi is speaking not about Bez Shalmato, but about Bez Shalmato. What is the age limit for Bez Shalmato? Huh? Bas Esrim Roshin. And Sarah was Baskov. When the threat starts, at 35. If you punish a man, if Dezen Shalmaila meets out punishment to a person who is 20 years old, apparently he's a sinner. If he weren't a sinner, he wouldn't be punished. And in general, I mean, in the age of mitzvah, the notion is 13 and 12. There's another problem too. This is more already a psychological problem. Rashi continues to say that Baschof kebazayin leyevi. And when she was 20, she was as beautiful as when she was 7. As a matter of fact, the age of 7 is not the prime time at which a female or a male reaches full development. This comes much later, as a matter of fact, at the age of 20. I would suggest that the Rashi should be inverted, rearranged. Bas kuf ke bas sheva lechet ma bas sheva lechoto share eino bas onshin and bas kuf lechoto u bas kuf ke bas hof leyefi. That's what I would suggest. As a matter of fact, it has no bearing upon my interpretation of the Rashi. This is just a parenthetical statement. But let us. I haven't checked on it. Perhaps it's just a brainstorm. This correction, I believe, would resolve many difficulties. But whatever the text is, whatever the genuine text is, what's the interpretation? What did Rashi want to tell us? Bas kufke bas chof, bas chofke, bas kufke bas zayin, lechet, leyefi. Rashi emphasized that the last part of the verse, Shnei Chayisor, is not to be interpreted in numerical terms. Answering the question, how old was Sarah at her death? Because this is unnecessary. Vayihu Shnei Chayisor, Meir Shono, the Esrim Shono, Vesheva Shonim, Shnei Chayisor. Of course, it's almost an independent sentence, Shnei Chayisor. You know very well, but it's a clause, certainly a good clause. You know very well that a sentence, or even a clause within a sentence, answers a question. If there is no question, there is no need to formulate a sentence. What question does the Shnei Chayisor, at the very conclusion of the verb, answer? I mean, prima facie, I would say, it would answer, it would address itself to a question, how old was Sarah when she died? But it's an impossibility, it would be nonsensical, because the Torah just stated, Vayihu Shnei Chayisor, Vayihu Chayisor, Mashonah Vesheva, Vesem Shonah Vesheva Shonim. So it's already the information was given. The information was given, so there was no need to repeat Shnei Chayisor. To repeat the question. But apparently, the question is not to be interpreted in numerical terms, answering the question how old was Sarah at her death, but has got to be understood in descriptive terms, related to another question. Namely, what is the other question? Who was Sarah? Who was she? Who was she? What kind of a person was this outstanding, regal woman? What kind of a life did she lead? What was the very substance of Sarah's personality? In Hebrew, I would say that the question to which means the last few words in the sentence, in the verse, are addressed, is not ma kamo hoyu shnei chayi soho, but ma hoyu shnei chayisor. What were the years? Not how many years, but what kind of years? So what is the answer? What is the answer that the Torah gives to this question? If the question were interpreted in numerical categories, then the answer would be is plain and simple. 127 years. She was 127 years old when she died. But if the question is, who was Sarah? What was, what kind of a personality did she have? Who was she? So what is the answer? Yes, yeah, I understand that. The answer that was offered by the Pentateuch to this question is quite a paradoxical one. You want to know who was Sarah? Sarah was a very strange person. Sarah was a 7-year-old, innocent child when she reached the age of 20. Sarah was a 20-year-old lovely girl at the age of 100 years. What Rashi says, what Rashi wanted to convey is the following. Sarah was an innocent child when she matured and reached 20, and when she was ripe in years, the number is not important, she was ripe in years, she still was a young, vivacious girl of 20. Shnei Chai Sorah, if you want to know the biography of Sarah, the whole biography of Sarah was formulated in 3 words. Shnei Chai Sorah. The rest consists just of details, which are not worth repeating or describing. Let me explain what I have in mind. Not so simple. Of course, by sheer association, I recollect the name Peter Pan whenever I come across the idea of Baschov ke Bazayan or Baskuf ke Baschov. However, you know Peter Pan by birth. However, the distinction between the Peter Pan story by James Barrett, I'm not mistaken, and the idea which Rashi tried to convey is enormous. They are completely incommensurate stories. Peter Pan is just a boy who refuses to grow up, or refused to grow up, to assume responsibility and to take his place alive. However, when Rashi says that Sarah, that she was like a child at the age of 20, and like a youngster, like a teenager at the age of 100, he did not intend to indicate that the development of her personality was stymied. God forbid, Sarah 20 was a mature, fully developed both intellectually and emotionally person. She was energetic, bold, and daring. So what happened? So how could she be Bas Chomish? What happened is the following miracle. The adult in Sarah did not destroy the child. Maturity did not do away with childhood. In the deep recesses of her personality, no matter how developed, no matter how capable and brilliant, no matter how attractive and ingenious, but in the recesses of her personality, always resided an innocent child. The adult might have reached the highest peak of intellectual greatness or growth. His creative cultural gesture might have been enormous. Yet, all that did not interfere with the secret presence of a child in Sarah. The same applies to the second equation. Baschov ke Baskuf, or Basay ke Baskuf, Bazayan ke Baskuf. When she reached the age of 100 years, she was still like a young girl. This does not mean that her mind did not ripen with age, that she did not benefit by repeated events in life, that she has not enriched her personality with wisdom and experiences. However, notwithstanding the maturation of her natural wisdom, she retained within her personality the young girl she was once upon a time. She acted like a mature, wise, experience-rich old woman, but in times of need, or perhaps crisis, The young, bold, courageous girl came to the fore and took over. In other words, what Rashi tries to explain, that the usual traditional sleep period of a human life, childhood, youth, and right age, are not mutually exclusive. They are not just successive experiences. They are simultaneous experiences for the covenantal woman. The latter does not pass from one to another. They do not replace each other. They can be experienced simultaneously. Sarah was at the same time, child, youth, and old. Woman, the capacity to be all three together, to experience existentially child, youth, and old woman is the sign of the covenantal community. Is the sign of greatness. It's paradoxical. But because it is paradoxical, it is the characteristic trait of greatness. And let me explain that in semi-halachic terms. There are three basic mitzvahs. I don't like the word basic, but they play a central role in our life, in our religious life. Namely, Torah, Talmud Torah. You know what Talmud Torah means to a Jew. I don't have to tell it to you. Emunah, it's the first mitzvah in the table of Tayyar mitzvahs. Tefillah, and Avas Hashem, I said three. All right, let us say four. Torah, Tefillah, Emunah, and Avas Hashem. But you'll pretty soon realize why I said three, not four. How does one study Torah? I'm in a yeshiva building, in a library, symbolic of human knowledge, of knowledge. How does one study Torah? And of course, the answer is simple. This is intellect. Talmud Torah is more or less an esoteric gesture. Not everybody can study and comprehend the Torah. As a matter of fact, all intellectual activity, scientific gesture, for instance, are of an esoteric nature. The more capable one is, the more time he can afford to spend on the study of Torah, the more scholarship he accumulates. The more profound his knowledge is, and the more refined his mind proves to be. The Zokin is the wise person, since he had more opportunities and more hours to spend in the Olah Shel Torah, in the tent of Torah. That's exactly the reason, you know very well, why the Bible has equated Zokin with Chacham. Maturity is important for the study of Torah. An immature mind cannot study, cannot grasp, cannot abstract, cannot analyze, cannot infer. The mature mind, the right mind, is capable of accomplishing miracles. From the viewpoint of Torah and Talmud Torah, the ideal person is a man rich in knowledge and wisdom and ripe in years. This intellectual wealth comes with years. God wants men to grow intellectually. Does God want men to grow intellectually, to develop, to train his mind? Of course he wants him to do so. To grow intellectually, to expand his capacity for analyzing, comparing, conceptualizing, inferring. To achieve complete maturity, full growth, because they are indispensable for Talmud Torah. As far as Talmud Torah is concerned, the grown up, the adult, the trained mind is the ideal person. As far as Talmud Torah is concerned, you cannot say Bas Kuf Ke Bazael, Bas Kuf Ke Bazael, Ben Kuf Ke Ben Kuf. Moreover, in order to be a great scholar, to be a learner, one must exercise criticism, be capable to criticize, not to take everything which his Rosh Hashiva or Rebbe offers to him. At times, you should even practice and exercise skepticism. Naivete is out of place. Obedience is damaging. In my classroom, is obedience is damaging. I accept because the Rebbe said so, means nothing. The student of Torah accepts not any halachic theory unless the latter was proven after he had reviewed it in his mind time and time again. And you all know the story about Rabbi Yechanan, who missed Reish Lakish as a study companion, as a study mate. And the rabbis sent him another scholar, Rabbi Elazar ben Bedor, to take Reish Lakish's place as a disciple, companion, and study mate of Rabbi Yechanan. But Reish Lakish used to argue with Rabbi Yechanan, ask questions. He did not accept Rabbi Yechanan's opinion. We know there are many controversies with Rabbi Yechanan and Reish Lakish, but Rabbi Elazar ben Bedor was a different time. Rabbi Elazar ben Bedor, Emdos was quick to agree with Rabbi Yechanan. He never argued and never tried to refute Rabbi Yechanan. Consequently, he was sent away. And Rabbi Yechanan said, I mean, if you want to agree with me, I don't need your agreement. I know that I'm right. Anyway, I want somebody to contradict me, to argue with me, and to try to refute me. Of course, the old and mature person is a skeptic and critic in a positive, constructive way. Some old people become vicious, sarcastic, but in a old age, in a constructive, positive way, gives the person a sense of criticism and skepticism, which are indispensable in the slavish. In a word, Torah was given to man because he's a great being with unlimited cognitive capacity. He is independent in his thought and free to disagree. Torah is the symbol of man's distinctive role in the universe. The more mature, the greater he is. The more brilliant, the greater his achievement. However, when we suddenly find ourselves holding the Siddur, or the prayer book, instead of the Gemara, from time to time we put the Gemara away, we take the pick up the Siddur. It's very important. Siddur is a very important book. We have discovered prayer. We have taught the world how to pray, and we have forgotten how to pray. You know, the Tanya, it's true, I tell the story, it's true. The Tanya said once that there was a young boy and he was a searcher, an explorer by nature, was very dissatisfied with the limited surroundings of his little town in White Russia, and he began to inquire about distant communities. He wanted to wander and to travel and to be and to study under the auspices of great men. So he says, I was told, the young boy, there are two centers. In one center, they study London. They achieve a guy in London. In the other town, they study the city. They teach how to do. Alumni was I was a little bit of alumni, but I did not understand a single word in the city, and that's why I went to Mezerich instead of going to Vilna. Vilna was the going, and Mezerich was the Mezerich Amagi. Prayer is an art. We have forgotten the art completely. It's not only a mechanical performance. It's more than that. It's an attitude. It's a state of mind. It is a mood. It is a great experience. It's an exciting experience. It's an adventure. But when man finds himself holding the prayer book, when he is about to recite his prayers, to pour out his heart before God, the scenery changes completely. And I want to say it's not in homiletical times that I use those words. I mean, not in a homiletical sense I use those words, but in a halachic sense. Halachically, a grown-up, an adult cannot pray. The adult, the proud mind, the independent thinker, the genius, all of them are not admitted to the Heichal HaTfilah, to the palace of Tfilah. They do not know the art of prayer. While Torah requires of man, Talmud Torah, requires of man self-affirmation and self-appreciation, confidence in his ability to understand and judge, to discriminate and equate. Tefillah demands of man just the opposite approach to himself, namely an approach of self-degrading, of self-negation. The mood which generates a desire for prayer is one of hopelessness and bankruptcy. Prayer is generated by the act of despairing of people and their power to help the suffering individual. Basically, to pray means to surrender one's pride, self-confidence, the awareness of greatness, freedom, and independence. If a man does not feel that he is completely dependent, but half dependent, halfly, he has no right to pray. Even when we speak about kavanah d'tfilah, what kind of a kavanah? We answer pirush hamilah. Pirush hamilah is not the real answer, the genuine answer. The Ram says, "Keimir lifnei hashchina," as if you were standing in the presence of the Almighty, confronted by the Almighty. And prayer means confronted by the Almighty. If one is confronted by the Almighty, so what does he experience? What does he experience? Yeah, I mean, I would like you to quote me a text for that. A text. The closer you come to the Almighty. Yes, yes, but the closer you come to Almighty, the more you realize how worthless you are. Yes, yes, yes. The one who described this experience beautifully was the Rambam. You have your Rambam, you say that there, does no. Okay. The Rambam speaks about Hava Sakadish Baruch Hu, to love God. To love God means to come near Him, to come closer and closer. This is the movement, the forward movement, to come as close to Sakadish Baruch Hu as possible. Yeah. But suddenly the Rambam says, men realize it, how little he is, how worthless he is. He is dependent, he is finite, he is mortal. Ayim kana mocha bekerah, today, here, tomorrow, in the grave. I mean, he is ignorant. And the very moment he realizes this, he begins to retreat. the backward movement. He engages the movement of recoil. And this movement of recoil and the realization of human complete dependence upon God and human nihility, this experience is what Ram calls Yira Session. And exactly this experience is the spring well of Tira. Of course, to pray, one has got to be a child. It is not a child in terms of. If he is sophisticated, very critical, he is skeptical, he's very intelligent, at least he thinks that he is intelligent, so prayer is not for him. Prayer is for one who is naive, who is capable of complete surrender, and of having complete trust in HaKadosh Baruch Hu, which who said to her, that only the child prays, rather the infant prays. He spoke about an infant prays, of course, David HaMelech. An infant prays, because the infant has unlimited trust in the mother. Shir HaMalis LeDavid, Lei Gova Libi V'Lero Enoi, Kagomul ale nafshi, kagomul ale imi. Like a wind child with his mother, so am I with God, who want to recite my prayer. What does it mean? Like a wind child with his mother, so am I with God. Not so much dependence as trust. No why. Somehow instinctively, the child feels that he is in the embrace of somebody who loves him very much, who will protect him with their life, who will do anything to make his life happy, to make him happy. And that feeling is the very root of prayer, of still out of in, out of the aloha, not out of the root, not out of the philosophy. That is the way, that's the manner in which the covenantal community prays to God. Complete surrender and complete trust. There is another act, a very important religious act, which only the child in man can perform, not an adult. And for the adult to perform this act means to turn the child. What act is it? What act? Only the child can perform. And if an adult wants on him to perform this act, has got to become a child first. As a matter of fact, the act about which I'm going to discuss is the root of prayer. Emunah. There is another act which only the child in man can perform. For this performance requires, it means faith. What does faith require? Trust, yes, of course. I'll tell you. The word faith in English, like many other words, has been, what shall I say, profane by applying it to man. I have faith in him. This, strictly, from a philosophical viewpoint, from a theological viewpoint, no one can have faith in man. It's blasphemy to have faith in man. have confidence in them, yes. But not faith. There's a difference between faith and confidence. But I am speaking about faith in God. I mean, because in Hebrew you cannot say, of course, I mean, Tcholakovsky, the Hebrew writer, right? Anima anim ba'adam. I have faith in man, but blasphemy. It's sacrilegious. It means deification of man. There's faith in people. Faith means an absolute act, complete reliance, without reservations, without conditions, without qualifications. And faith means also complete trust, that person in whom I have faith will never betray me, never, never, never. To say I have faith in man means to contradict the statement by David, call Adam Kizis, every man is a liar. And you cannot have absolute faith in a liar. To be a liar is human. And that's why it's not proper to say I have faith in man. Confidence, yes. Confidence is a relative term. First of all, faith in God requires of man complete trust. Complete, absolute, unqualified trust. That's the metaphor which David employed in order to illustrate or to explain what faith means. The little infant has faith in his mother, almost an absolute sense. Because he had never experienced what? Call Adam Kizis. He's so naive that he doesn't know the verse in the Psalms. A near mark in the Chavzi, call Adam Kizis. However, faith in HaKadosh Baruch Hu requires of us something else. And it's very important for us to know. Because many people, well-intentioned and committed, don't understand that aspect. And if American religious community would have understood that aspect, we would be rid of many problems. Problems which rabbis confront every day. And I'm an active rabbi and active rabbinate, so I confront those problems in the same way as you do, all of you, all of us. Faith requires of the faithful suspension of judgment from time to time. Suspension of judgment. Or shall I be more brutal? Suspension of the logos. Surrender the logos. Because I tell you, if you studied Greek philosophy well, you would know what role the logos played in Greek philosophy. This was the idol number one in Greek culture. Idol number one was logos and nous. They had two idols. Suspension of the logos. Surrender not only of the body, but of the mind. Faith in Mune confronts man with a challenge, sometimes, not always, to suspend his judgment, to act irrationally, to act illogically, to act even though he doesn't understand why he's acting in a certain way. As I said before, faith confronts man with the challenge to suspend his judgment, to do away with the very principle or norm he has been preaching all his life. Only a man-child, can surrender and suspend judgment. I remember when Chaim, my son, was a little boy, he had almost unlimited faith in his mother. So whenever he was asked a question, he used to say, what did mama say? And he actually, as a child, he used to suspend, he was a very capable child. He used to suspend his judgment, very intelligent, because of his unlimited trust in mother. And that's exactly the way an adult should do. In relationship to God. But an adult can't do that. Who can do it? Only a child. So the adult has to arouse to wake up the child again. And tell him to form on your and my behalf an act of faith. I'll join you, but I don't have the courage. I'm too vain. I am too proud to do that. You do it for me, and I'll join. Such a performance was required of him. Suspension of judgment, not sacrifice of Abraham. What did God require of Abraham? Not only his son, of course, to offer a son, the only son, his successor, his spiritual heir, was difficult enough. But God required more from Abraham, more than this, to suspend his judgment. As a matter of fact, this idea is mentioned in Midrash. I want to know. It's known more or less in a different fashion in the name of Kierkegaard, but actually the source is in Midrash. After all, God has decreed, Shefer damo Odom bo Odom domi yishofer, ki bitzelem elekim osa Sodom. Whoever commits murder should be executed, because if you murder a person, you kill a person. You kill a being who was created in the image of God. Abraham undoubtedly was teaching everybody who cared to learn and to listen that murder is abominable, that it is a heinous crime, that human sacrifices are abominable. He was engaged in inexorable struggle with the pagan priests. He used to build altars. Abraham built altars, yes. But something is very characteristic of Abraham's altars. He never sacrificed anything on the altar, with the exception of the last altar he built on the Mount Moriah, on which he sacrificed the ram as a substitute for Isaac. But the Pharisee mentioned several times Vayivan Shom Ezbeah, an altar, but a bloodless altar. Vayikro Shom B'Shem Adishem. He built altars, but never sacrificed anything on them. God does not need blood. And suddenly that Abraham received a call. A call came through. God is speaking to him. What did God demand from him? Lech lecha me'atzcha? No. A human sacrifice. Not important. Might have been somebody else. Abraham would have been confronted with the same nisoyim, the same task. A human sacrifice. His own son. Abraham could have asked, immediately, my master, you appointed me as your apostle, your representative, to teach the people how to worship God and how to practice morality and to hate cruelty. So many years have I been fighting pagan practices. So many years have I been preaching and speaking against the ugly custom of killing young children on altars. Now you command me to do the same thing. What will the world say? How will I be able to explain it to myself? I have followed you since the time we had the first rendezvous somewhere in Wisconsin. I've never rebelled against you. But now you have the impossible. I should suspend my humanity. Well, you know, all Abram did not say a single word. Not a single complaint came forth from his mouth. Silently accepted God's command. Suspended is logical, as well as his moral judgment, suspended his own humanity, and was ready to do the very thing he hated the most. The adult could not do that. Only the child or the infant was capable of absolute unconditional surrender to the point that man gives up his own humanity, his own conscience. And that's exactly what God demands from us. Suspension of judgment. But with us, it isn't as bad as it was with Abraham. All God wants us to do is not to rationalize many mitzvahs, and not to try to explain every and each mitzvah to ourselves, and say, this mitzvah makes sense, other mitzvah doesn't make sense. All we have to do is accept the Torah in total. That's all. And it's, in the matter of fact, it's not suspension of judgment, the way it was with Abraham. Our minds are very limited. Our rational capacity is restricted. We are frail beings. We are ignorant. The fact that our intellect does not digest some chukim does not mean that God wants us to suspend our judgment. A sense of modesty suffices. Just modesty. Those people, in particular, it has become quite this rebellion, the refusal to suspend judgment, has become now the shibboleth of conservative Judaism. Yesterday somebody told me that the next new word I'm going to introduce is that the girls are chayav b'pidyon haben. Not pidyon haben, but pidyon haben. I'm not concerned about the religious angle. I'm concerned about the moral angle. It takes a lot of chutzpah. The chutzpah, not arrogance, but chutzpah. Abraham had a great intellect. Abraham himself combined the enemy. The child, who is capable of complete surrender, and the great intellect to discover the Ribbono Shel Olam. Abraham had a great intellect. He explored the starlit heavens of Mesopotamia. He was engaged in astronomical calculations with the Rambam portrays him. He studied the movements of planets and the fixity of stars. He realized that the world is not a multiple affair, but is guided just by one principle, and that behind this principle, which is responsible for the entire cosmic dynamics, stands the Almighty. Maimonides writes of Abraham, he had no teacher, no one to instruct him. He was submerged in Ur of the Chaldea among silly idolaters. But his mind was busily working and reflecting till he had attained the way of truth, apprehended the correct line of thought. In short, Abraham was an intellectual giant, a genius, of a frightening stature. His judgment was mature, right. He was not a child, and yet he was capable to transform himself into a child and to accept the order from the Almighty to suspend his judgment and suspend his humanity and do something which is inhuman. And it is not a coincidence that this great Abraham, as Kierkegaard calls him, the knight of faith, with a K at the beginning, right? The knight of faith The night of faith is the first Jew to pray. He discovered prayer, he discovered faith in God. Because both require just one transformation, one metamorphosis, namely, from adult into child. And how did Abraham pray? How did he pray? In the mood of an intellectual giant? Or in a different frame of mind? The famous statement, "Von Necher auf Weifer." Enough. Abraham, whose glance boldly penetrated the starlit heavens of Mesopotamia, who courageously revolutionized human thinking, turned into a little child, into dust and ashes, into a little child, when it was about to pray or when it was about to perform the act of faith. However, the Torah requires adulthood. Prayer and faith require childhood. And one should be ready for both. Should be capable of assuming either the identity of a child or that of an adult. But the Torah also, but Abraham, but not only an old man was Abraham, not only a child, a little child was Abraham, but Abraham was something else, namely, Nazokin is an old man, but not only an old man was Abraham, not only a little child was Abraham, he was also Bas Chof, she was a Bas Sheva, old woman, ripe in years, mature, Bas Sheva, child, naive, innocent, capable of surrender, and absolute, unlimited trust. But she was Bas Chof too, and so was Abraham. The covenant was given to two. Sarah and Abraham personalities merge into one, into the covenantal personality. She was 20 years, she was also a youngster of 20 years, a young, vivacious girl. But not only an old man was Abraham, not only a little child was Abraham, but he was also a young man at the same time. Full of enthusiasm, vigorous, courageous, overflowing with ecstasy. Why is it necessary for a man to be not only two personae, but three personae, to be old man, child, at the same time, to be capable of assuming the identity of a young man? Of course, because the Torah requires of men not only to study, not only to pray, but to fight. If a principle is involved, then you have to champion the cause of justice or decency. And to fight for justice is the job of the young man, you know, who is drafted into the army. The little child cannot fight, nor can the old man fight. The young man of draft age is a fighter, can struggle for the cause of justice. He displayed that youth. Don't forget, he was an old man when the episode happened. The episode which I'm going to tell you about, you know, and I never forget. You know this episode? Yeah. He was an old man. He was 75 years old when he arrived in Eretz Kanaan, in the Promised Land. And that happened much later. He was a man of 80, 90 years old. And when Lot was taken prisoner, Abraham displayed tremendous fortitude, heroism, and he pursued the five kings who conquered the land, fought them, engaged them in battle, and emerged victorious as a young warrior. And when Abraham studied the skies of Mesopotamia and discovered the Almighty, he was an old man, a zokein, bodesh tayomim. And when he prayed, He was kigomul aleime, kigomul alenafshi. He was like an infant. And when he engaged the five kings in battle, he fought like a young warrior. Like a young man, he's expected to fight. He's supposed to fight. We asked before, what is the covenantal personality which the covenant, which God, which was fashioned by the Ovid, by Sarah and Abraham, Isaac and Rebecca and so forth, and what kind of a personality was it? One trait of that personality we know now. The basic characteristic of covenantal men and women is the existential dialectic with which he or she is burdened, an awareness of greatness as well as of helplessness. Awareness of courage, reckless fortitude, as well as awareness of skeptical doubt. It is the threefold personality that is so indicative of the covenant, the covenantal community, namely child, youth, and old man. Ve'ele chayi sora, me'ye shono, v'sheva shoni, v'esrim shono. You want to know who Sarah was? She was 100 years old, she was 20 years old, she was 7 years old. And that is the biography of Sora, Shnei Chayi Sora. But there is another aspect to the patriarchic covenant. The patriarchic covenant has created this not only a covenantal personality, as we have just described the covenantal personality, but a covenantal historical destiny as well. Perhaps, I don't want to be too much of a chauvinist, of a Jewish chauvinist. I would say the covenant has created the concept of historical destiny. Without the covenant, there was history, historical experience, but there was no destiny. The covenant injected a new concept into history, namely that of destiny. What does this destiny represent? By what virtue is it distinct from other historical experiences? I believe that covenantal history differs from other historical processes in two respects. First, as far as causal determination is concerned. Secondly, covenantal destiny is a dialectical one. There is duality to the covenantal destiny. Let me explain what I have in mind. The main distinction between the universal and covenantal historical events lies in their different dynamics. Historical dynamics at the universal level is of an etiological nature. Means every event is brought about by a preceding cause. The cause precedes the effect. What event A occurs, B follows A. Or to be more colloquial, A begets B. The cause of the event, the cause could be both. Proceeding and following. A begets B. The historical universal causality is of a mechanical transient nature, namely the origins determine the event. The present was precipitated by the past. If you speak to historians now, they'll tell you this correct. Now, interpretation of history is completely mechanistic. The covenantal then, in my opinion, should be placed in a different causal context, namely teleology. Not theology, but teleology. Purposism. The covenantal dynamics is sustained by the covenantal promise, or by the goal which lies temporarily outside of the community. Let us take a simple example now. Eretz Israel. It's a very strange phenomenon. The whole Eretz Israel experience as a state and the universal opposition to the state of Israel is a covenantal experience. I mean, you cannot explain it in plain universal terms, categories. But the commitment of the Jew is due to effect what? Because it's a promised land. So the promise is the cause. So what is the cause? Not some event in the past. The cause is anticipation of something beautiful, something miraculous, something magnificent in the future, or the fulfillment of the promise. Don't even the most secular Zionist now or political leaders speak about messianic hope? So the idea of messianism actually generates the commitment on the part of the Jew to Israel, even though it's a mad commitment. In other words, history and in covenantal history, the future is responsible for the present. Therefore, the covenantal experience can only be understood in unique covenantal categories. The universal forms of thought are inapplicable to covenantal events. You cannot explain in plain psychological, historical terms the Jewish commitment to Israel, as I told you. It's a mad commitment. It's completely irrational and still a very strong, almost an unconditional commitment. This is the first. So the covenant has created a new concept. Concept of destiny. What does destiny mean? I forgot to look up in the dictionary. What does destiny mean? What is destiny mean? What does destiny, the word destiny, convey to you? Yeah. What does it convey? It conveys something to you. Destiny, by mere association, when you say the word destiny, what do you think of? Of destination. Of destination. It's one root. What determines our historical process, historical experience of the Jew, is not the point of departure, but what? The destination. He travels somewhere. He's not just wandering around. He's a traveler, an experienced traveler. And there is a destination toward which he is rushing. And he wants to get at the destination as soon as possible. Which determines the unfolding of Jewish history. What is the destination? Where is it on the map? Where is the destination? No, I have a better destination than that. That is all we'll see. Vayemahu yiyah deshem echod ushmei echod. The eschatological redemption of the, not only of mankind, but of the world, of the universe. That's what the covenant has created. The covenant is responsible for that. However, historical destiny can also be characterized by another trait, not only by the trait of teleology or destination, but by another trait. There is a contradiction in our historical destiny, or in our historical experience. The contradiction consists in the fact that there is no purely covenantal historical exterior. And the reason is obvious. Jews have lived since the days of Abraham among non-Jews. Not only they lived among non-Jews, they dealt with non-Jews. We read this morning about the transaction between Abraham and the Bnei. He lived among them, he dealt with them. Modern Jew is certainly entangled in the general society. The Jews are integrated into the gentle society in a hundred ways, economically, politically, culturally, socially. Consequently, we share, since we live among them, we share in the universal historical experience as well. Problems of humanity are also relevant to the Jew. Universal problems of humanity. Famine, epidemic, fatal diseases, war, political oppression, materialistic atheism, permissiveness and so forth, immorality and so forth and so on. Pollution of the environment are problems which history has addressed not only to the general community, but to the covenantal community as well. We have no right to tell mankind these problems are exclusively addressed to you. We have no right to do that. God charged man with the task of fighting evil, of subduing the destructive forces in nature and convert them into constructive forces. And the Jew is a member of mankind. So the command of God, Urdu Boretz Kifshua, is addressed not only to the non-Jew, but to the Jew as well. The Jew as a human being is duty-bound to contribute his bit to the general welfare, regardless of the treatment accorded to him by society. Sometimes we are not happy about it. Rashi quotes the Midrash, that's here. Now it's a concession to homiletics. Now it's a concession to homiletics. Rashi quotes the Midrash that Hebron had the name of Kiryat Arba because it was a city where four couples were buried. One couple was Adam and Chava. The three others consisted of the patriarchs and the matriarchs. The question is simple. Why was Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and their wives buried in the same order, in the same cave, where Adam and Chava were buried? In order to demonstrate that there is no gap between Adam and Chava and Adam. There is no gap between human dignity and Jewish covenantal sanctity. I believe responsible for this coincidence is our view that Abraham did not appear in the historical arena in order to free the Jew from his historical human obligations. God forbid, the covenant on the contrary enhances the universal Noel and elevates it to greater heights and adds many more norms to those which the Jews accepted as a human being before the covenant was reached. The trouble, there is no contradiction between the laws which are rooted in the idea of imago Dei, of dignity of man, and those based upon the concept of Kedusha. The trouble lies with our non-Jewish neighbors who have never understood the covenantal commitment. Never. Now when I meet gently intelligent Gentiles, usually I meet intelligent Gentiles, so they cannot grasp it, they cannot digest it. They cannot grasp simply the legitimate rights of the Jew to Eretz Israel. And I'm not a bad teacher. And I can explain sometimes most complicated, what shall I say, concept. But I fail miserably in explaining our relationship to Eretz Israel, to the non-Jew. Very intelligent people. They don't understand, of course, Eretz Israel now is the central issue in international politics. But they don't even understand, in general, how covenantal commitment. Not only don't they understand, they resent. They have never understood the covenantal commitment. They look upon us as if we were a strange, enigmatic bunch of people. Hence, tension is created between the Jew and non-Jew. It's not anti-Semitism, am I? I'm not speaking about anti-Semitism. Tension. It is existential tension. Because the Jew has a commitment which the non-Jew does not understand. The latter would like the Jew to have the general commitment, to identify himself with his non-Jewish neighbor. And when we repeat to them, to our friends, and some of them are friends, and neighbors, the words of Abraham, which he addressed to the two heads, Lato shvulatem shvulachem imachamer, ve'ani ve'ana neuchlatkei, ve'nishtachave, ve'neshuva aleichem. Abraham in that sentence has described in the most gorgeous manner the tension between Jew and non-Jew. Between the two heads, who had a universal commitment, and he and Isaac, who had in addition to the universal commitment, a covenantal commitment. The universal commitment he called pay. The covenantal commitment he called K. And K is a difficult word in Hebrew. Sometimes K signifies pay, and sometimes K has the meaning of Shom. What does it mean? No, Ato is Yatzef Kei Alezecho, I mean before he departed. Here, stand here, wait for me. And Abraham used it in a different form. Vaniva na milchat kei, at shomo of Nishna. The goy doesn't understand the difference between pei and kei. And the conflict between us and our neighbors is acute. But it's worth actually experiencing this tension in order to be an elected community and be the descendants of Abraham.